Good afternoon. May it please the court, Santino Tricotti. I represent the appellant in this matter, Torian Daniels. We submit two arguments on appeal to this court. The first one, an insufficiency of the evidence, a motion that was denied at the Superior Court, and we contend that the trial court erred in his denial because there was insufficiency of evidence to establish identity in this case. And the second argument is an alternative argument, and that is, should this court find that there may have been sufficient evidence to allow the case to go to a jury, at the very least, Mr. Daniels is entitled to a new trial under the great weight of the evidence standard that this case fails to satisfy. Before the court is the rare case of a record entirely bare of credible, untainted evidence of guilt. A case so insubstantial, the trial judge found it to be one of the weakest cases that the state has put forth before him.
What are we to make of the comments that the trial judge put on the record at sentencing, at least, it's at sentencing as I understand it, when he says, I wish there was something I could do about it? What were his options if his comments at sentencing were his reading of the case at the conclusion of the trial? What were his options?
Well, Your Honor, we would contend that his first option was to grant the motion for judgment of acquittal. And based on the language that Your Honor raises, which was at sentencing, it's unclear why having such discontent for what he saw transpire, the motion for judgment of acquittal was not granted at that time. Secondly, the case law that we submit to this court in our papers point to the fact that a motion for a new trial can be done sua sponte at the Superior Court. And that was option number two to the trial judge.
There's where I'd like you to educate me. Let's assume that we were to agree that the court has inherent authority to sua sponte grant a new trial. The court sees, as his sentencing comments would suggest, a miscarriage of justice just occurred. On what factual or legal basis does the judge rely when he comes to that conclusion? Or does it have to be based on some plain error that occurred at trial? Can it just be a conscientious reaction to a verdict that strikes him as an erroneous verdict? He or she has to have some kind of framework for analysis. What do you suggest it is?
The case law suggests that if the judge finds it to be a miscarriage of justice or a verdict that no reasonable jury could find, that is manifestly and palpably against the great weight of the evidence, a new trial should be rendered. This court has reviewed motions for new trials before. We see it in Luskin. We see it in Story.
Is it a different standard when there's an actual motion for a new trial filed to which the judge is responding after briefing than when he sua sponte decides he has to grant a new trial in the interest of justice?
Is Your Honor referring to this court's on appeal or the trial judge's?
I'm referring to the trial judge. The principled basis on which a trial judge could, under these circumstances, at the conclusion of the trial, sua sponte, grant a new trial.
Sure. And I think to answer Your Honor's question, it is this court has held, based on what trial courts have rendered in the past, that it is a great weight of the evidence standard, whether it goes against the great weight of the evidence.
Let me ask you the same question in a slightly different way. Going to your first issue about the judgment of acquittal, let's assume hypothetically that was properly denied because there was testimony that did identify the defendant, even though it might have only been one person. But we have a lot of cases that talk about testimony being some credible evidence to either justify the denial of a motion for a judgment of acquittal or to support a lesser included offense.
Sure.
Now, if we assume that that's the law, then notwithstanding denying properly the motion for a judgment of acquittal, how does the judge either on motion or sua sponte in this case say, nevertheless, even though there was some testimony to support this, I am going to grant a new trial? Because, help us with the because. What's the basis for doing that? You seem to suggest because it's against the great weight of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. And the unique circumstance in this case and is that the jury was permitted to entertain a verdict based on dubious in-court identifications. We know that the state brought 13 witnesses to the stand who were at the scene of the alleged robbery, and six of them did not identify Mr. Daniels entirely. Seven did, and of those seven, six admittedly were highly intoxicated on the evening that this occurred. So much, these individuals were not socially drinking. They were binge drinking. They were drinking for the purpose of being intoxicated, and the record would suggest that they were successful. So successful that they did not even notice the perpetrators assimilate into their party before the alleged incident occurred. And if the court looks at the record, it's clear that based on their testimony, these individuals saw all different accounts. There are more than seven different accounts of clothing. There are different accounts of what they look like, their height. So to answer Your Honor's question, we would suggest that the evidence that the court was permitted erroneously to consider should not have been considered at all because it was tainted. Now, sticking to the record, we know that Mr. Daniels was stopped on the evening of the robbery when Officer Barrett was told to look for three African-American males. Mr. Daniels was walking alone, and since he was the first African-American Officer Barrett encountered, he decided to stop him. Mr. Daniels fully cooperated, provided ID, and consented to a search, which yielded no fruits of the crime whatsoever. Still unsatisfied, they decided to get Donald Sayers, one of the alleged complainants from the incident, to come to the scene to do a show-up identification. Now, we know that show-up identifications after a reported incident are reliable, and so reliable that the Supreme Court has established that suggestiveness is not an option because it happens right after the crime. Mr. Sayers is brought to the scene, they shine a flashlight on Mr. Daniels, and they say, does this person look familiar? This is someone who just had a face-to-face encounter with a perpetrator 20 minutes earlier. He not only does he say, no, he doesn't look familiar, he says he doesn't want to send an innocent person to jail. Well, now Mr. Daniels is in jail because 2 weeks later, Mr. Sayers changed his mind while seeing Mr. Daniels speaking to officers in Newark and says now he's the right guy. This is the miscarriage of justice in this case. There is no physical evidence whatsoever. Furthermore, with respect to the judge's comments, let me back up for a little bit. That's one layer that really taints these in-court identifications that were done in court. As we submitted in our papers to this court, every single individual who ID'd in court Mr. Daniels was Caucasian. And there is scientific evidence and studies done which indicate that cross-racial identifications are not reliable. So much that jurisdictions have permitted jury instructions about this exact theory.
Was an instruction along those lines requested in this case?
No, it was not. And I don't believe Delaware has decided whether those jury instructions are permitted. But more importantly, Your Honor, is the fact that when taken entirely, when you take these identifications, they should be given no value whatsoever. And it's what the court used, it's what the jury used to convict Mr. Daniels.
What remedy is available to your client, assuming that we find that the judgment of acquittal motion was properly denied and there's no authority to sua sponte grant a new trial? Consistent with the federal rules.
Mm-hmm.
What is the remedy, if any, available to your client under Rule 61 to raise any of the concerns that you're raising now?
Well, under Rule 61, and I'll answer Your Honor's question and then go back, I guess, procedurally to ask what this court can do. Under Rule 61, Mr. Daniels can certainly raise the issue that a motion for a new trial should have been requested at trial, okay? But on direct appeal, Your Honor, that argument under Supreme Court Rule 8 can still be asked, which is what this court did in Monroe, which a motion for judgment of acquittal was not done in a timely fashion, and it was waived. This court deemed it waived in Monroe. Nonetheless, the court said, in the interest of justice, had the motion been made, it would have been granted. And that's the exact situation we have here. Had Mr. Daniels made a motion for a new trial at the conclusion of this case, the evidence the jury verdict goes such against the evidence that certainly a new trial would have been permitted. And that's what the trial court echoes in his sentiments at sentencing, when he says that he has no idea how that jury room came to this conclusion. Now, the state would suggest that he made an inexplicable statement, but there's nothing inexplicable from a reaction from a judge, highly respected one at that, who's heard countless hours of testimony in his career, has seen all kinds of jury trials, and has come to the conclusion that unfairness has taken place. That's what he did in this case. And the record would suggest that there isn't even sufficient evidence for the jury to have entertained such a verdict. That's really the problem here. Those in-court identifications were so dubious that no reasonable fact finder could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Daniels is the alleged perpetrator. This is your prototypical misidentification case. It's the ones that are constantly regarded because somebody points the finger on the witness stand, and there's nothing more damaging than live testimony such as that.
But that is something that could be raised in Rule 61.
That the motion for a new trial should have been asked for, or the insufficiency?
The insufficiency, or not? Can that be raised?
I'm sure it could be raised again in Rule 61. Sure. But this is on direct appeal, and there's enough evidence here for this court to establish that there was a patently insufficient establishment of the essential element of identity in this case. Going also to the record, Katie Blasco, one of the witnesses. She testifies that she does an in-court identification before trial. She testifies that not only can she not pick out the right person, the police tell her she picked out the wrong person, and they show her who they have, Mr. Daniels. This is someone who points her finger to Mr. Daniels in trial. Why? Because she's been shown Mr. Daniels prior to trial. This is an in-court identification that the jury was permitted to review. That's tainted, and the jury used that to convict.
Was it objected to?
The identification?
Her testimony that said, I, in effect, identify the defendant as a perpetrator in the courtroom. Before she testified to that, was there a motion to exclude it?
No.
Was there an objection when she was asked the question?
Trial counsel echoed the tainted nature of the inquiry identifications when she provided her motion for judgment of acquittal. And all of these points were raised when trial counsel asked for the motion for judgment of acquittal after the state's case.
How critical was that one piece of so-called eyewitness testimony in the scope of the entire circumstances of the trial?
The in-court identifications were they encompassed the entire case for the state.
But hers as opposed to anyone else's. Would one argue it was cumulative? It was just another in-court identification consistent with others?
Every single witness who got up on the witness stand and pointed their finger at Mr. Daniels, they were all just as prejudicial.
Clearly they were prejudicial or they wouldn't have been asked the question and gotten the answer. I mean, there's no question about that. What I'm trying to get at is if this particular one was tainted because of some suggestive pretrial identification process prompted by the police, was there no motion to exclude it, and was there no objection before she testified? But even if there weren't, was it one of six, and it was the only one that was tainted by pretrial identification process?
Your Honor, we would argue that every single one was tainted based on the circumstances of how they came to their conclusions. Secondly,
there's a major distinction between a jury resolving whether or not someone's perception at the time would be accurate and ultimately credible when they testified, and a constitutionally impermissible pretrial tainting by the police.
Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize. I may have let me be more clear as to the factually what happened. Ms. Blasco was given a show-up identification. She pointed to the wrong person. She never did point to Mr. Daniels. Not that the police showed her one and said, this is the guy, and then she pointed to him. Her identification was done in court when asked, who did you see that night? The point counsel is making here is what Ms. Blasco was probably pointing to is the individual that the police told her they had arrested prior to trial. Not that it was suggested before court.
Okay.
I see that my time is, I'm into my rebuttal, so.
And raising
sure.
I'll adjust it back. I'm concluded, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. In the early morning hours of October 6, 2007, Torian Daniels and two other individuals went into the apartment located at 236 East Delaware Avenue. How do we know that? We know that because Samantha Minelski said Torian Daniels and two other men went into that apartment building on that night, and she identified him in court. The next we hear...
let me make sure I understand your statement. She said Troy Daniels went into the...
Torian. No, she said... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did she identify him in court as someone who went into the apartment, or did she say, in effect, I knew Daniels and I saw him there that night?
No, Your Honor, none of the individuals knew Daniels. All of the identifications in court were to the extent of, that's the guy I saw that night.
Okay.
Just to be clear. We next hear that some individuals are going into the apartment owned by Donald Sayers and Mike Fry. There's a party in progress. The party has been going since approximately 10 p.m. the previous evening. Two of the men force the entire group back into one of the bedrooms. The lights in that room are off because someone is sleeping. And at some point, they say, shortly after the group arrives in there, turn on the lights. The lights are on, and the group begins to hold guns to these individuals and collect their property. Admittedly, virtually everyone who identified Daniels that night had been drinking. Minelski testified that she had not been drinking, but she was outside the apartment. Blaskow, Bell, Swearingen, Sayers, and Darby all identified Daniels in court. Blaskow, Sayers, and Darby all said Daniels had a gun. Daniels was one of the men holding guns on me. Sayers and Darby both said Daniels had two guns. At some point during the robbery, one of the men handed his gun off to Daniels. Daniels at that point was holding two weapons. William Bell and Jaron Swearingen both said they had no doubt that it was Daniels that he saw that day. All of these witnesses have been sequestered. All of these witnesses came in independently, and none of these witnesses equivocated when asked if they were sure. They were sure it was Torian Daniels who'd done it. This conclusion, the conclusion that the evidence was sufficient, was clear from the end of trial testimony when the motion for judgment of acquittal was made. And the judge said, it's certainly true that some of the victims were unable to identify the defendant as a participant in these robberies. But it's also true that other victims did positively identify him as a participant. And while those identifications are subject to criticism, that's a jury issue as to whether those identifications satisfy the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was a participant in these crimes. That conclusion was manifestly correct. Credibility, as this court has said, is a matter for the jury. It's said over and over and over again. Credibility is reserved for the jury. Here, every complaint, aside from the cross-racial identification component of Mr. Chakotay's brief, was presented to the jury. The inconsistencies in their statements, the circumstances of their initial identifications, the facts that they had been drinking, these facts were all before the jury, and the jury resolved the credibility claims in favor of the state.
What do you make of the judge's comment at sentencing?
Your Honor, I described it in my brief as inexplicable, and I cannot change that characterization today. The judge said that the state had seven witnesses. There were more than double that. Only one of them could identify you, the judge said. That clearly was not true. Seven identified at trial. And yes, there was no physical evidence, but that's about all that the trial judge got correct in this case. It's apparent that he simply forgot the trial record.
Could the trial judge have granted him a new trial sua sponte?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
This court has said in Maxian that a late filed motion for judgment of acquittal or motion for new trial under Rule 33 is barred. The Superior Court has no jurisdiction because the time limits are jurisdictional mandatory. The federal rules, while having gotten rid of that jurisdictional mandatory claim, have said that late filed, that's a mandatory case processing rule. Here, the state had no opportunity to respond to a late filed motion because there was no motion, and the federal rules are clear.
Well, I don't think we're talking about filing a motion late or not filing a motion at all. What about the inherent authority of the court to prevent a manifest injustice? Could the trial judge if he believed the situation to be, at the time the jury rendered its verdict, the same as he expressed when he sentenced Mr. Daniels, could he not have acted on his own and set aside the verdict and granted a new trial?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Not at that moment. Now, he could have certainly suggested to counsel that it would be appropriate to file such a motion, but Rule 33 says that a defendant has a certain period of time to file that motion. It doesn't permit the trial court to do it sua sponte on its own motion.
If the rules addressing the circumstances under which defense counsel can or must act in order to file a motion, that's one thing. But you're not suggesting that because it says this is what you do, defense counsel, if you want to file a motion for a new trial, that doesn't bar a trial court judge from granting a new trial in order to prevent manifest injustice, does it?
Certainly, if during the motion for judgment of acquittal, if the judge had said, I find that this verdict is against the great weight of the evidence, that may have been a different circumstance because it was within the 7 days.
Well, there wasn't a verdict then. How could he?
If he had said, if the motion for judgment of acquittal had been renewed afterwards or had been presented to him in some request, the state would suggest that once the jury's verdict is in, for the judge to act, the request has to be made.
There's a difference between granting a motion for a judgment of acquittal, which ends the case, exonerates the defendant, and saying, as trial judge, I'm not satisfied with this proceeding. I think there was a manifest injustice or a miscarriage of justice, and I'm going to grant a new trial. Those are two different results, aren't they?
Yes, Your Honor. Clearly, the standard for against the great weight of the evidence is different from that used in assessing sufficiency of evidence under Jackson v. Virginia. The state, however, would suggest that Rule 33 requires that the defense move for a new trial on those grounds, or a new trial under any grounds, quite frankly. Here, there was no such motion.
So you're back to the position that a trial judge has no jurisdiction or authority or power, however you want to phrase it, to prevent manifest injustice in the absence of a defense motion?
Well, certainly there are alternatives to doing it precisely the way Your Honor is suggesting. As I suggested in my brief, he can go back on Rule 61 and say that it was ineffective for counsel not to file.
Let me make sure I'm clear. I want an answer from you. Your position is the judge has no power, jurisdiction, or authority to prevent manifest injustice at the conclusion of a trial. Is that your position?
Based on the great weight of the evidence, yes. Certainly the judge has inherent authority for mistrial-type events during trial.
So in this case, the defendant was sentenced to 23 years in jail. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the trial judge said, I wish there was something I can do about it. I don't agree with what the jury did. However, I am helpless to grant you any relief, and you're simply going to go to jail for 23 years.
Until, certainly, the Rule 61 will go right back to Judge Babiarf's in this case. If they file a motion for under Rule 61 that asserts great weight of the evidence, and the judge, again, is presented with the facts and circumstances of this case, then certainly he can consider it there. Here,
so
clearly,
the great weight of the evidence is the new trial standard. Is that correct?
Yes. The fact is that the only evidence we have from
But wouldn't judge, it be a procedural bar to raising that claim?
It would be ineffective assistance of counsel for not raising it. And certainly if he can demonstrate, if the judge believes that the motion would have been successful, then counsel would have been ineffective.
Being asked to decide whether or not there was error in denying the motion for judgment of acquittal. Assume we agree with you that motion should have been denied. Won't that create a procedural bar in a Rule 61 on the sufficiency of the evidence?
On sufficiency, but not against a great weight of the evidence claim. As a few of the courts have noted, there is a distinct difference between the two. While a claim may meet the burden of Jackson v. Virginia, in that there is some credible evidence in the record from which the jury can decide that this individual is guilty, It is different from saying that the evidence is not outweighed by evidence of his innocence.
Is there some issue in your mind, given the trial judge's statements at sentencing, that were this to come before him a year or a year and a half from now, as a practical matter, after he's retired, that he would come to a conclusion different than he would come if he thought he had the ability to decide it at the time of the jury verdict?
I believe if Judge Babiarz were presented, or his successor, were presented with the evidence from trial, the record at that moment, he would conclude, as he did at trial, that the evidence was sufficient.
But we have the practical problem that we suspect Judge Babiarz will be retiring before this would ever come back before him on a Rule 61. The judge who took over the case would not have seen the trial, would not have been able to come up with the expressions as strongly and hyperbolically expressed as Judge Babiarz expressed them at sentencing, would have no idea why Judge Babiarz had that kind of reaction. He would be left, or she would be left, with nothing more than the same record that resulted in a denial of a motion for a judgment of acquittal.
That's absolutely correct, and that's why the State, Your Honor, is suggesting that the motion for new trial, based on these grounds, needs to be presented to the trial judge right then and there, because that judge just sat through the trial, just assessed the credibility of these witnesses, and is in the best position at that time, not 6 months later when he's sentenced, at that moment.
No, I couldn't agree with you more on that, but the issue as I see it is we have a statement from a trial judge that's the strongest statement I've ever seen on the record by a trial judge questioning the fairness of the outcome of a trial. Never seen anything like it. Been practicing law 39 years. The question is, what can be done about it, and what can be done about it, if anything, should be done about it now, because the judge who saw the trial will be gone by November of this year in all probability. This defendant will be in jail between now and the time a Rule 61 could come up, a year and a half from now. Where's the justice if what he says at sentencing is something that's substantive and not just a ameliorating comment to the defendant at the time of issuing a harsh sentence?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest first that the judge was apparently satisfied with the discussion right after trial, and that his conclusions here, his statements at sentencing, were largely incorrect. However, the trial judge...
What were the discussions right after trial?
I believe it was just sufficiency of the evidence. I don't know if there was any extended discussion between the trial judge and counsel after that.
Are you suggesting there was some discussion that related to whether or not the result was a manifest injustice?
No, I don't believe there was any discussion at all about manifest injustice other than the motion for judgment of acquittal.
What does the record show was the discussion right after the verdict?
As far as I'm aware, Your Honor, there is no discussion after the verdict. I'm unsure, however.
So you're talking about the ruling that denied the motion for a judgment of acquittal. That's what you're characterizing as a discussion?
Yes. Okay. And at that point, Judge Babiarz had no particular compunction about saying that he was satisfied with the evidence as it was presented against Mr. Daniels.
Well, let's consider a policy issue. And let's assume it's a good rule to have a time limit for filing a motion for a new trial by defense counsel or in the state, and that if you don't file it in time, you're barred, and that's the end of it. When we're talking about the judge's ability to prevent what the judge perceives to be a miscarriage of justice, what are the policy considerations that we should address when we decide whether the judge should be able to do that sua sponte, irrespective of any time limits?
Your Honor, I believe that the policy considerations that underlie at least the federal decisions on why a judge cannot do this sua sponte is because it has to be presented to the judge at the time, and the state should be given an opportunity to respond. And the formal motion process of Rule 33, that happens.
Well, let's suppose that's certainly a helpful comment. and let's suppose the judge says to counsel, I'm inclined to sua sponte grant a new trial, but before I do that, I'd like to hear from both sides.
I'm assuming, Your Honor, this is within the 7-day window?
No, this is any time. You know, in other words, no one's made the motion. The judge is just concerned that there's been a miscarriage of justice. Let's assume it's beyond the 7 days. And rather than just do it sua sponte and send out a letter in the mail saying I'm granting a new trial, the judge sends out a letter that says, I'm concerned that there's been a miscarriage of justice. I'm considering granting a new trial on my own motion. But before I do that, I'd like simultaneous comments from both parties. What would be the problem with a procedure like that?
While it would preserve the state's right to argue this way, it's the judge going back after trial, after everyone's in the best position to argue this, and doing something that's plainly not contemplated in the rules.
Can he grant sua sponte a Rule 61 motion? Or raise it sua sponte? Instead of saying, I'm not granting a new trial under Rule 33, under Rule 61, I find sua sponte that there should be post-conviction relief.
Admittedly, Your Honor, I haven't referred to Rule 61 aside from that this provision would be available to Mr. Daniels at that time. I don't believe the judge would be permitted under the rules either to say of his own motion, I grant Rule 61 relief, because once again, he would have to do that on the basis of the attorney was ineffective for not doing this, and that would involve a more thorough discussion than would presumably be available at a oral argument.
My recollection is that judgments of conviction in criminal cases do not become final until sentencing. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir.
So why would it be bad policy? Why would it be a mistake to consider that in the inherent power of the court that any time from the rendering of a verdict up until sentencing, a trial judge could exercise his inherent power to act when he believes there's been manifest injustice as a result of a trial by taking a logical process, either writing counsel, if not saying directly to counsel immediately after the verdict, contemplating for a few days, and then writing counsel and saying, counsel, if this had been a non-jury trial, I would have found this defendant not guilty. This has to be one of the weakest stakes cases I've ever seen. How this jury room came to its conclusion, it's just absolutely beyond me. I wish there was something I could do about it. All I can hope is that you catch the real guys and get some evidence against them, and they confess. On that basis, I have counsel under consideration, under my own power, granting a new trial. You have, as Justice Holland pointed out, X days to respond. As long as that occurs before sentencing and the judgment is final, why would that be bad law or bad policy?
It is. I cannot say that that would be bad policy. As a matter of policy, I cannot say that that would be the rule. However, there was a thought process that went into Rule 33, that why this had to be within 7 days.
This is not that rule. This is not defense counsel exercising professional judgment about why or why not in the course of the strategy of the trial to file a motion for a new trial. This is a trial judge whose conscience is shocked by the outcome, whose role with the robe is to prevent injustice, acting within the inherent authority of a judge. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, again, Your Honor, and I hate to harp on this, he was incorrect. There was more evidence than he recalled at this time. And I think this comment is the best reason why we don't permit a judge to do this.
The issue for me, Mr. Wakely, is not whether he's correct or not correct, but when I see a judge passionately object to a result and say there's nothing he could do about it, it troubles me. And whether he ultimately reached the conclusion that you suggest would be wrong or not, should he not have the power to say to counsel, let's address this issue. It troubles me so much. I can't just sit back and say there's nothing I can do. I have to take one more step between now and sentencing when these convictions become final. What's wrong with that? Even if he ultimately turns out to be wrong or he makes the decision that the state thinks is incorrect, it's appealed to us and we reverse him. Why should our trial judges feel disempowered to act when they passionately believe they've just sat through a trial that resulted in manifest injustice?
They have the power to do so within the time period right after trial. If they develop that feeling later on, there's a reason that Rule 33 deprives them of that power, and it's because they may be incorrect.
So your position is the judge could grant a new trial sua sponte within the time contemplated by Rule 33, but can't do it beyond that time.
Your Honor, the state would certainly not suggest that the court can do it of its own motion. However, within that time period, the judge can certainly tell trial counsel, I have a problem with this verdict, file a motion under Rule 33. Trial judges have done that type of thing in the past, and while the state may not like it, it's permissible.
Are there double jeopardy issues behind the time limits and the federal position that a judge cannot act sua sponte?
Under the great, and I forgive me, I am over my time, but I will answer Your Honor's question. The federal rules have, at least when dealing with the great weight of the evidence standard, what they've said is, there is a difference between great weight and motion for judgment of acquittal, the Jackson standard. If this court finds that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law, retrial is barred. If it's against the great weight of the evidence, at least one federal court has said that is tantamount to disagreeing with the verdict. The evidence was sufficient, but I disagree with it, and that can go back and be retried.
Okay. Over a defendant's objection?
I can't envision a period where a judge would... you mean be retried over a defendant's objection?
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the great weight, under the great weight standard, a defendant can be retried if that is the basis for the decision. I believe that's cited in at least one of the cases in Mr. Ciccotti's brief. And under the Jackson standard, the defendant cannot be retried. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wake.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did you want to put the podium back down to be helpful?
Sorry. No problem. You need it all the way down.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I will be brief as I see I am down to seconds. I would simply suggest that Justice Holland's point regarding the technical rules and the Chief Justice are something of concern when we're essentially saying that what the state contends is the judge is bootstrapped and cannot do anything in these types of situations. We would suggest that's not the case. But more fundamentally, if I can just finish, this court, under its power, also has the authority to ask the question, had Mr. Daniels' counsel filed a motion for a new trial when the time period was permitted, would that have been granted based on this record? That's what Monroe tells us. We can ask, under plain error, had he filed that motion for a new trial, and I see my time is up, can I conclude?
Oh, yes. Actually, Mr. Wakely, because of our questions, went over 3 minutes. I'll give you another 2 minutes.
Thank you. Had Mr. Daniels asked for a motion for a new trial, Monroe tells us that this court can look at that and can say, at that time, does the record support the fact that that motion would have been granted? And the record, as troubling as it is, as it troubled Judge Babiarz, clearly shows, at the very least, a new trial. We would suggest it shows more than that. It shows an outright acquittal, but at the very least a new trial. I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.